And now for reading and writing and radio.
John was the most mischievous boy in Parson's Court. He could sink his father's shoes in the rain barrel and not feel guilty. So when he tied the 3-year-old baby on a helium balloon and let it go, he only felt rather glad that Benny was gone. John went inside and made a jelly sandwich. He walked into the living room, wiping his hands on his Sunday shorts. He sat down in his father's favorite chair and started picking at the leather upholstery. He heard a car drive in. "Jonathan," his mother called, "you knew that was Benny's favorite balloon. Why did you let it go?" John walked over to the couch and pulled out some stitches. "Don't get mad," he said. "Benny still has it."
The author of that bit of horridness was Jillian Jackson. But it could be you. WSSR Radio at Sangamon State University presents Reading and Writing and Radio, a program about creative writing. Your host is Jacqueline Jackson, children's author and professor of literature at Sangamon State University. Here to begin today's show is Ken Ost.
Jackie, I recognize the title, "When She Was Bad, She Was Horrid," as a Mother Goose rhyme. But what's that Mother Goose book you have?
A couple years ago, I came on a version of Mother Goose. Lots of people have tried to rewrite Mother Goose because they feel that what is in it isn't as good as it ought to be or as good an example for children. And this particular version, The Happy Mother Goose, has gone through all the poems and has tried to cut out everything unpleasant in the Mother Goose. For instance, it's three kind mice, and the farmer's wife cut them some cheese with a carving knife, and Dr. Foster went to Gloucester in a shower of rain. He stepped into a dry doorway till it was dry again, instead of stepping in a puddle up to his middle. And when you get to the poem about there was a little girl who had a little curl right in the middle of her forehead, and when she was good, she was very, very good, and when she was bad, she was horrid. In The Happy Mother Goose, they have it. And when she was good, she was very, very good, and she never was naughty or horrid. And I brought this version home and showed it to our kids, and they read it through with mounting disgust. Some of their comments were, "Who wants to hear about somebody standing in a dry doorway?" And three kind mice, they've known three blind mice since they were babies, and they liked that particular version. And when it got to the little girl with the little curl, they just hooted with derision that anybody was always good and never was naughty and horrid. I think that mere evidence would show us that little girls have to be bad some of the time, and not just looking at other people, but when we look inside our own hearts. And I'd carry that further. I'd say big boys and big girls are almost driven to be bad some of the time, and that goes for grown-ups too. I've had ugly thoughts very recently, and I have said things that I know would hurt people very recently. It's not something we can learn to control these sorts of things and perhaps not do the mean thing that the thoughts bid us to do. But it's pretty hard when somebody is mean to us not to immediately react, to feel, to do something mean to them. We may not smack them back or cut them down in the same way. It may just be because we're not clever enough. But these are very human feelings. When somebody is treating us badly, we react by trying to treat them badly or treating somebody else badly. We do things bad.
Well, bad can mean several different things. Now, what do you mean, really, by bad?
Well, recently we talked about badness, naughtiness, where we do things that we don't realize are bad or naughty, that either in our own hearts it doesn't seem to us anything that we shouldn't do, and it doesn't occur to us that in the outside society, mothers, fathers, teachers, older brothers and sisters, that we are doing anything that they are going to object to or tell us is bad or naughty. I'd say for today, the sorts of things I'm thinking of are the things that we do in full knowledge that somebody is going to get their backs up, or get his back up pretty badly by what we've done, and that we just go ahead and do it anyway. And sometimes we just feel so reckless and mean ourselves. Usually something has set us off, whether we realize it or whether we don't, that makes us act that way. Now sometimes, too, and it's again a delicate sort of thing to tell the difference, sometimes the things we do that are deliberately going against what we know other people want, we may again feel in our hearts that there's nothing really bad with it, but that the difference here is that we do recognize that even though we don't think that it's particularly bad or naughty or vicious, somebody else is going to interpret it that way. Then another distinction I think that we could take into account is what's the difference between really doing bad, evil things and just merely being mischievous. Now, in Jill's little, the beginning of her book about Benny's balloon and tying Benny to the balloon, she starts out that John is the most mischievous boy, and yet, by anybody's standards, tying your baby brother to a balloon and letting him fly off into the sky is a pretty serious sort of thing, except, of course, that it's a silly, fun little story. If you've read Tom Sawyer and Huckleberry Finn, well, you see all the way through in those stories that Tom and Huck are doing mischievous sort of naughtiness. They're sliding out of windows, they're camping out on islands and causing their parents and guardians distress. While I'm thinking of Mark Twain, I should mention a funny little story of Mark Twain's that has to do with being good and being bad, because Mark Twain had lots of thoughts on these subjects. A story of a man who climbs onto a railway carriage, and the children in the railway carriage are being very noisy and disturbing, and he says he'll tell them a story, and then he tells them the story of the little boy that was so very good, and all the time he was so good that he kept winning medals for being good, and he would add medal to medal for goodness. And the climax of the story comes when all the bad little children who have never gotten any medals for being good and the good little boy are out playing in the fields, and he has on all his dozens of medals for being so good, and the wolf comes along, and the bad little children who aren't weighted down by a chest full of heavy medals all scamper away, and the good little boy gets eaten up by the wolf because he can't get away so fast. And the end of the story is where the man climbs off the railway carriage, leaving the children's mother or guardian or whoever is there looking very much scandalized. That's one of our favorite stories.
Well, I grant you, the goody two-shoes idea can get a little dull after a while. But on the other side, is badness a frequent theme in literature?
Yes, there's a very rich literature of horridness, of children doing horrid things. And these stories make very good reading. Our kids always like to hear about the times that they did bad things. I've never forgotten sitting on the stairs with my sister when we were little kids, and she just leaned over and bit me for no reason at all. That's a story that our kids have liked to hear. And I'm sure this is one reason that so many of these stories have been written down, or that episodes of children being horrid are used. The Laura Ingalls Wilder books are true stories by Laura, by Mrs. Wilder, about when she was a child. And she recounts her own ugly thoughts and her own unhappy feelings. And one passage where Laura is deliberately naughty is when a friend, and I say that in quotes because she doesn't really like Nellie, comes to a party out in the country. And Nellie is very offensive, informs Laura's mother that she, of course, didn't wear her best dress just to come to a country party, and in various other ways makes herself unpleasant. And Laura is just furious. And so she discovers, while they are playing, a way that she can get even with Nellie. And so she takes Nellie to the creek that they live by, and there is a big old crab that lives under a rock in the creek. And she frightens Nellie with the crab so that Nellie runs upstream and stands in the still, deep, muddy water. Then while Laura goes back and forth, pretending to scare the crab and be sure that he's out of the way, why, something happens to Nellie up there in the deep water that Laura knows is going to happen.
Nellie came out into the clean water. She said she didn't like that horrid old creek and wasn't going to play anymore. She tried to wash her muddy skirt, and then she tried to wash her feet, and then she screamed. Muddy brown bloodsuckers were sticking to her legs and her feet. She couldn't wash them off. She tried to pick one off, and then she ran screaming up on the creek bank. There she stood, kicking as hard as she could, first one foot and then the other, screaming all the time. Laura laughed till she fell on the grass and rolled. "Look, look," she shouted, laughing. "See Nellie dance." All the girls came running. Mary told Laura to pick those bloodsuckers off Nellie, but Laura didn't listen. She kept on rolling and laughing. "Laura," said Mary, "you get up and pull those things off or I'll tell Ma." Well, then Laura began to pull the bloodsuckers off Nellie. All the girls watched and screamed while she pulled them out long and longer and longer. And Nellie cried, "I don't like your party. I want to go home." Laura didn't care. Deep down inside her, she felt satisfied when she thought of Nellie dancing on the bank.
Laura doesn't regret that naughtiness at all. But I think there are many times when we are doing horrid things that we are unhappy while we're doing them, even though we feel a certain grim satisfaction in getting even. But then afterwards we do have regret. Sometimes yes, sometimes no. The whole book of Harriet the Spy is dealing with this sort of thing. Harriet has her notebooks. She writes down things in her notebooks about her friends. And the climax of the story comes when she loses her notebooks and her friends read in these notebooks about themselves and then start ostracizing her, being mean to her. She has meanwhile had a terrific, traumatic experience at home, in that she has been raised all her life by an unusual sort of woman, a nursemaid, you might call it, named Olgali. And Olgali has left to get married. So that Harriet is suddenly both alone, without Olgali, to whom she's always confided, parents that she can't communicate with and who are pleasant enough but baffled and not really, during the story, deeply interested in their child. And then she has lost her notebooks. Her friends have discovered all these, to them, horrid things that she said in them. And so they're out to get her. And Harriet gets more and more and more upset. And they have hurt her so badly, and she herself is hurt so badly by having Olgali leave, that she is out to hurt her friends just as much as she can. And so here is a passage where she is thinking how she can hurt them. She's writing in her journal.
Harriet didn't even hear. She ran into her room and flung herself on the bed. She lay quietly for a minute, looking reverently at her notebook, and then opened it. She had had an unreasonable fear that it would be empty. But there was her handwriting, reassuring if not beautiful. She grabbed up the pen and felt the mercy of her thoughts coming quickly, zooming through her head, out the pen, onto the paper. What a relief, she thought to herself. For a moment, I thought I had dried up. She wrote a lot about what she felt, relishing the joy of her fingers gliding across the page, the sheer relief of communication. After a while, she sat back and began to really think hard. Then she wrote again. Something is definitely happening to me. I am changing. I don't feel like me at all. I don't ever laugh or think anything funny. I just feel mean all over. I would like to hurt each one of them in a special way that would hurt only them. And then she made a list. Marion Hawthorne, frogs, put one in her desk. A snake would be better. Rachel Hennessy, her father, ask her where he went. Laura Peters, her hair, cut it off or make a bald spot.
And so on. And then the next day at school, she tries to do those things. She finds a frog in the park. She takes it to school.
She ran to her homeroom and lifted the top of Marion Hawthorne's desk. Then she carefully put the frog down inside. The frog hopped once and stared up at her peevishly. She stared back at him. She had grown rather fond of him, and she hoped nothing happened to him in the confusion. She closed the desk softly so as not to frighten him, then sat down primly in her place. The children all came in. While they were standing up saying good morning, Harriet grabbed a chunk of Laura Peters' hair and chopped it off with some scissors she had ready. Laura Peters didn't feel a thing. She sat down quite happily, never suspecting that she had a large chunk cut out of her hair. Harriet stared at the spot with a kind of joy.
And then the frog is found, and there's a great deal of excitement, and she goes home. She gets home, and the cook says,
"Why are you home?" The cook said ever so softly. "Why are you whispering?" shouted Harriet. "I have a new cake in the oven," whispered the cook. "It'll be ready in a minute. You mustn't bounce around or walk heavy or shout because it will fall." Harriet stood there. She munched a thought over in her mind. Without warning, she ran to the center of the room, overturned a chair, then jumped up and down, stomping her feet with all her might. The cook screamed one long scream and flew to the oven. "Look what you've done, you terrible child! That does it. I quit. If I have to put up with you one more day, I'll go stark, raving, yelling crazy. And it's not worth it what I get paid for."
Well, now here, you see, is a child being upset by circumstances and deliberately doing wrong things. The book follows through to explain how Harriet works these things out with the help of some older people and gets back into equilibrium with her friends so that she doesn't want to hurt them anymore and that they don't want to hurt her. So that in writing down an experience of this sort, it not only makes interesting reading to yourself or to your friends or to others, but it might help you to understand that experience much better, to see what your own feelings were. Afterwards, did you feel triumph, delight, joy, as Laura did with the bloodsuckers? Or do you feel regret and self-pity and that I am not myself at all, I feel mean all the time, and that after you've done the mean thing, you feel even meaner, as in the case of Harriet?
Well, then, as we write today, we'll be thinking of and, for the most part, dealing with our emotions.
Yes. Those are the most interesting part of all, at least equally as interesting as the details of what the horrid thing was that you did, how you got back at your brother. To tell step by step, as well as you can, how you felt, what caused those angry feelings, and what was the result after you had done whatever bad thing you did? Did the punishment make you feel better? Sometimes you say about a child, he's just aching for a spanking. Usually that's a little child. Did you want a punishment, or did you not? Or was the punishment out of proportion for what you did? Or did you not get a punishment when you think that you should have, and so you felt guilty about the thing that you had done? These sorts of discussion in your story, including these details of how you're feeling, make it a much more vivid story. Somebody else can feel the story with you, and they'll say, that's the way it happened to me. Or else they'll say, that's the way it happened to you, but when I did such and such, I never felt the least bit sorry for making so-and-so suffer. She deserved every bit of it.
All right, Jackie. And if you young authors can get those vivid details of horridness down on paper, let us know, okay?
WSSR Radio has presented Reading and Writing and Radio. Send your writings to Jacqueline Jackson, Sangamon State University, Springfield, Illinois, 62708.